Welcome to Dragons and Jive, episode 3, sucka. How are you, Herman?
I'm great, thanks, brother. I'm Jive Tolkien, you know, I'm trying to stick it to the man, and I'm enjoying some sweet soul music here, early R&B.
You know what? If I got the chance to live in an old movie theater, like that was my base of operations, I'd be on that in a second, man. You get to see all the free movies.
Dude, I would love that. Yeah, no, I would love that. And Cage doesn't seem to be taking advantage of this, you know, fortuitous location that he finds himself in, right? Low rent, great movies showing downstairs all the time. A little bit of an irritating guy like DW hanging around all the time. But, you know, I mean, he seems to be, you know, good for Cage, you know. But, yeah, I would be watching movies all day long, man. In fact, recently I read, you know, the Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips second series called Reckless, which I once promoted to you, Billy, on Into the Weird show, right? This guy is based, he's like a PI, right? Private investigator, based in a movie theater. He owns his own movie theater. and yeah, but it's cool. Only his. It's only for him. You know, it's more like his pad. It's not running. You know, but he just watches old movies all day.
That's awesome.
And thinks about the cases. Yeah, man, it's great. So yeah, Luke Cage, great. I mean, think about superhero headquarters or superhero bases. This is one of the most unique, right? Luke Cage being based in this old, you know, fly trap movie theater.
I love it.
So, but you know, Shang-Chi though and Iron Fist, they're more like vagabonds. They're walking around all over New York, and they don't seem to have anywhere to lay their heads. In fact, I don't know what Shang-Chi does for food. What does he scavenge in the dumpsters?
he's like a raccoon.
yeah. Or he's an aesthetic, you know, like one of those Eastern mystics. They only eat like one caviar egg a month, and they can subsist on that. These gross fakirs from India. Yeah, man. Ugh. Mm-hmm. I'm not a caviar fan myself either. But some a couple of great issues that we've got lined up for our patrons today, right, Billy? We've got this time around Shang-Chi starring in his very own title. You know, it's not Marvel Presents anymore. This is Master of Kung Fu. Okay, it starts off with as number 17 with the numbering. But, in the past it used to be just, Marvel Special Edition.
Right.
And now it is transitioned to Master of Kung Fu proper. So that's why, you know, when people start collecting Master of Kung Fu, they always think, why isn't there a one? There's a giant-sized Master of Kung Fu number one, but there's no regular series title number one because it started with 17. But, of course, he debuted in 15 of Special Marvel Edition. So, Billy, then we've got Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, number 3. Whoa, this is... number 3. A classic Luke Cage story. I think you and I would both agree. Coming off of a classic, you know, where he defeated his arch nemesis, Willis Stryker, in the previous one. And now we've got another good one showing that there's more goodness on the horizon for our buddy Luke. And then Iron Fist, you and I were lukewarm on this one, right? Which is Marvel Premiere number 16. Still with Larry Ama on art. Not bad art at all. Writing by Doug Munch. It's not going anywhere. You know, it's just there to showcase Iron Fist's skills. But I'm thinking we can put some added, oomph into the discussion of it as we pull it apart. But definitely the Master of Kung Fu issue and Luke Cage issue is pure gold. So we're going to have lots of fun talking about that.
For sure. Yeah. The Iron Fist, it was not bad. It was just a little vanilla.
Yeah. So we'll get to some great issues down the line. We all know who's going to be the creative team on Iron Fist soon. It's going to be Claremont and Byrne, their first collaboration. Oh, then it's going to shine. And then, you know, eventually we'll get to Iron Fist and Luke teaming up.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'll have the Power Man and Iron Fist buddy team. And that's what the show, well, what we're working towards, right, Billy, is that fantastic run by that, you know, Iron Power Man and Iron Fist series. But, you know, Shang-Chi is actually the mainlining this Dragons and Jive, really, because he's arguably the most successful and most famous comic book series and, you know, also character that came out of this particular Kung Fu kind of blaxploitation era. Not that he had anything to do with blaxploitation, but, you know, we're marrying the two genres. So, yeah, it's going to be Shang-Chi, and then, of course, we're going to get to the great, fantastic issues down the line. But there will be some mediocre issues we're going to have to plow through, just for continuity's sake. But we'll make it fun for you, Patreon listeners, I'm sure. So, Billy, we'll start off with Master of Kung Fu, number 17. And I'm going to just give some specs, and then we're going to start off with your synopses there. We're doing the Twitter style again. So short synopses, but, you know, you and I were suitably of a different mind, but firmly liking the same stuff. But we're different when we give our synopses and descriptions, that it'll give you two sides of the story, I'm sure. All right, so this time around, we've got Master of Kung Fu, number 17, edited by Roy Thomas. And it was, of course, written by Steve Englehart and Jim Starlin on pencils. And then inked by Al Milgrom. Lettered by Tom Arkowski and colored by George Russos. And the cover is by Ernie Chan. You know, the great Filipino master from inked Conan the Barbarian along with John Buscema on pencils. So he's a legend. I love Ernie. And this title of this issue is Lair of the Lost. And a whopping 19 pages. It was cover dated April 1974, but on sale in January of 1974. And it was only 20 cents. Ooh, that would be nice. Well, we had that, Billy, when we were kids. But yeah, now, too expensive. In fact, whatever Shang-Chi series is printed now is so expensive. I haven't even tried out any of the issues. I'm probably not gonna. Normally, I do try out new issues of a character I like, but there is a Shang-Chi series running at the moment, I think. It's just I haven't even looked at it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's to hype up and kind of mirror the film that's coming out. And yeah, it's not really getting my interest. So
yeah, you and I, now we're going to talk about that. We haven't talked about this on Twitter yet or on the regular Into the Weird show. Our Patreons will be the first to know, and they might disagree with us. Yeah, you and I are both not feeling the Shang-Chi trailer because it's got nothing really ostensibly to do with the Shang-Chi comic. So I mean, even the guy looks completely different than the character in the comic. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible to make every comic book character look like they do on screen as they do in the comics, but this is such a departure. I mean, number one, they've got the Mandarin as his father. They've got the Ten Rings. Boo, yeah. They've got the Ten Rings, which is magic-based. Shang-Chi's universe does not have magic. In fact, Shang-Chi is about espionage. It's about a James Bond-style Kung Fu action hero who's coming from the old world into the new and then having to adjust to the new world. Here, it seems to be the opposite. It seems to be Shang-Chi already well-adjusted in the new world. He's escaped his father's clutches, and then he has to return to the fold. We've seen this story so many times, right, Billy? Now, we've also seen the story where, you know, it's kind of like a Babe in the Woods character where you're, you know, from an old world setting into the new. We've also seen that with Captain America, so maybe that's why they didn't want to do that. I don't mind that, but just be true to the mythology of the character. Like, you know, there's no magic associated with Shang-Chi and Ten Rings and, you know, and all of that. It's just... it's too modern. The update is a little bit too modern for me. They could have easily like bought the license to have Fu Manchu on film from Sax Rohmer's estate, I think, because they're Disney, they're Marvel. But they didn't go that way. They decided, okay, we'll just keep it in the Marvel universe. The Mandarin is now again, you know, it makes sense that the Mandarin is his dad. It doesn't make sense to me.
No.
I mean, the Mandarin doesn't carry that weight of Fu Manchu, I think, you know, with, but, you know, in the Marvel Universe, Mandarin is a legit villain, but he's Iron Man villain. So, okay, so whatever. But you and I, we didn't feel the trailer. Long story short.
Yeah, so, no, I would have much rather, like you said, they just got to the rights for everything from the Sacks-Rohmer estate and just done like a period piece in the 70s, and just like this comic was, and have it separate from the MCU.
Yeah,
that would have been a dream for me.
Don't tie it into the Marvel Universe. Sure, Shang-Chi did, have interactions with the rest of the Marvel characters during the Bronze Age, yes, but it was never a part of his continuing storyline, you know, which is him versus Fu Manchu. I don't know. It's just too much for me. But I think the biggest gripe I have is the fact that it is this concept of the Ten Rings, you know, and the magic they represent. It's just got nothing to do with Kung Fu, you know. So, yeah, he's the master of Kung Fu, but this is more just like, you know, putting Kung Fu on the back burner. I would have loved if they had done, because Shang-Chi is a direct, he was inspired by the Bruce Lee films and by the characters Bruce Lee portrayed on screen. And, of course, other martial arts movies as well. But, you know, so why didn't they try to do some homage to something like Enter the Dragon indirectly or something, you know, or, or keep it, I don't know. It's just, I'm just nitpicking here. You know, we're old guys, Billy, get off our lawn types. Sorry about that, patrons, patrons. But yeah, we're not very psyched for the movie. This issue, though, is a classic, you know, Billy, because it's the return of Dennis Nyland Smith to Shang-Chi's world, but also of a character that will become a supporting character for the rest of the run, and we'll get to him. But he's suitably badass enough to give Shang-Chi a run for his money, and so far, only Midnight has been able to accomplish that, and he was in Fu Manchu's stable, the man called Midnight who died in the previous issue.
Yeah.
And then in this case, we've got someone on Dennis Nyland Smith's camp, MI6, who's capable of giving Shang-Chi, you know, quite a battle. So we'll get to that. But Billy, first, your synopsis, Twitter style, what is it for this issue?
Okay, so introducing Black Jack Tar. He's big, he's mean, and he's a hired hand out to avenge a death. And he's got the chest hair to do it.
Dude, this guy's hairy. Wow. Her suit. Yeah, very bearish. Yeah, no, you're right. That's great. That it sounded like you were introducing a new WWE wrestler there. That's cool. He does look like that. He looks like he could snap Hulk Hogan like a twig, you know?
But, yeah, he's funny. He kind of reminds me of myself. He's got hair all over his chest, and he's got no hair on his head.
but you know, he's like one of those James Bond villains that sometimes show up, and then you see that oh damn, he's made to break people, and then eventually the Bond character gets the better of him, but by luck or by fortune. You know, turning his way. That's the only way you're going to beat this guy. He's one of those guys, you know.
Yeah.
But he's going to, like I say, stick around throughout the series. So we'll see why. He's going to have a mutual... They're going to develop a mutual respect between, you know, Shang-Chi and him. But this issue is mostly about Dennis Nyland Smith, I think. You know, coming to grip with his need for revenge. And, you know, Dennis is one of those very intelligent characters that, you know, revenge is not... They eventually come to realize that revenge is not the best option. And this is him coming to that realization, I think. Because after all, what happened in the very first appearance of Shang-Chi in Special Edition 15, he killed Dennis Nyland Smith's best friend, Dr. Petrie. He was still under the sway of Fu Manchu when he did it, so he didn't mean to. He thought he was ridding the world of a great evil. You know, Shang-Chi did when he killed Dr. Petrie. But, you know, of course, Dennis Smith's out for revenge. But in this issue, we'll see, you know, it's not your typical revenge tale at all. In fact, it's completely unique, right, Billy? Stands on its own as a very interesting issue. So
Good character.
Yeah, man, great character. All of them, really. Mm-hmm. And then my synopsis goes as follows. Shang-Chi seeks out Sir Dennis for some much-needed Western-style wisdom in Black Jack Tar's New York pad. and he beats up a whole array of foes in the process. Face to face with Blackjack, he overcomes his toughest opponent and ends up curing Sir Dennis by shaming him to his feet. As we all know, Dennis is in a wheelchair, Charles Xavier style, because of some horrific injuries done to his legs by Fu Manchu and his henchmen, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's real gross looking, too. Oh, like, he pulls his pants leg up and shows us what his leg looks like, and it's nasty.
Yeah, the way Starlin draws it, man. Ooh, pink flesh all twisted and mangled, and you just know those bones were crushed to powder, right? So it looks worse.
But look at that cover.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
What a cover by Chan.
Yeah.
Got Blackjack looking more massive than he truly is, but it's pretty close in the comic too, the way he's drawn. But
he's here, a big, very big guy. Yeah, very big guy.
But here, you know, Chan ramps up the giganticism with Shang-Chi doing a classic flying kick into Jack's midriff, seeming to have no effect, right, Billy? Now,
and then there's a text box there.
Yeah, can you read that for us? That's great.
Yeah, it says they call him Blackjack. The man not even Kung Fu can smash.
Yeah, because as up to this point, I think if you've seen all the Bruce Lee movies and then started reading Shang-Chi, you think, okay, Kung Fu is everything. If you're a practitioner of Kung Fu, nobody can beat you. You know, it doesn't matter if you're small, thin, weak. You're a Kung Fu master. Mm-hmm. You can take out a whole regiment of tough guys.
We see it right here in the first page, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, let's get into this, man. Now, okay, first, Billy, we've got to say that this is the classic creative team and the creators behind Shang-Chi, Engelhart and Starlin. Jim Starlin and Steve Engelhart, they created the character of Shang-Chi after many late-night movie matinees where they frequented theaters in New York, where they just binged, you know, Kung Fu movies. They came up with the Shang-Chi character, of course. So this is them, you know, still showing their love of the Kung Fu action genre.
Yeah.
But fantastic opening splash where we've got these two images juxtaposed. You know, they're put side by side. Shang-Chi's
like a
about,
split-screen TV.
Yeah, split-screen TV. Yeah, that's the best way to say it. Shang-Chi's about to get mugged by junkies. And then an effigy of Shang-Chi, almost a scarecrow-type mannequin, is being pummeled by daggers in the second image. And one dagger in the wall, stabbed into the wall, has, you know, pins a wanted poster for Shang-Chi to the wall.
Yeah, he had a little run-in with the cops in that last issue, so there's already a warrant out for his arrest, I guess.
That's right, man. Yeah. Shang-Chi's wanted by more than just the cops. He's like wanted by Interpol too now, because as we learn, Sir Dennis, he's got his fingers in every pie all over the world when it comes to international espionage, right? So he's got MI6 in his camp. He's got Interpol, and then of course, like you say, the New York police are after Shang-Chi after he laid out a cop with a pipe. You remember? Well, not a pipe. It was one of the bamboo message, container. But still, it's pretty violent, pretty brutal towards the cops there in New York. So you'd think they'd have the APB out on him. And you know, how can you miss a character like Shang-Chi? No wonder he's sticking to the alleys. But these guys are about to jump him, right, Billy? Now, wait. I want to ask you something. Now, look at those guys. I think that is Jim Starlin, Roy Thomas, maybe, or Al Milgram, and then Steve Engelhart, maybe.
It could be. I'm trying to think. I've never seen, I don't know that I've ever seen a, or if I can't, I have, I can't recall it, what Starlin looked like back in the day. Because that, like you said, that Roy Thomas, the guy, one does look like Roy Thomas, the glasses and like the mop blonde hair.
Yeah.
For sure.
But they even have the names. I mean, the one guy's called Steve, the other guy's called Al. So that's why I'm thinking that Al Milgram might be the Roy
Al
Thomas
Milgram
lookalike.
Yeah,
yeah. But or it could be Steve, you know, because but they're definitely based on people from the Marvel bullpen, you know. So yeah. Al Milgram there, Steve Engelhart, but we don't know. The other one might be Roy. It might be Jim Starlin. We don't know. But, you know, I think Jim Starlin was more hippie looking. You know, he had long hair. you know, when he came out of Vietnam, he immediately got rid of all his short-cropped hair. And I've seen some early pics of him, but he doesn't quite look exactly like this guy with the long hair, you know, so.
Yeah.
Still interesting, you know, but he's definitely the one called Jim, the one with the blonde hair and the stash.
And then you got the other side of the page with Blackjack going full on, you know, racist here.
Yeah. Now, yeah, he's a very racist guy and he keeps his racism with him. But it's more like, yeah, it is racism, but it's also he looks down upon weaker people, you know, weaker, smaller foes. And he keeps calling, even though they become really good friends throughout the series, later on, I should say, he keeps calling Shang-Chi Chinaman. And he calls people for instance, the lackeys of Fu Manchu, Chinaman too. So, you know, he looks down upon, unfortunately, the Asian race, which is bad. And he's a racist type of character. But he's soon going to be redeemed, if you know what I mean, Billy, through acts of heroism and... right now, yeah, he's definitely a racist, a reprehensible character. And Dennis Smith is just fueling that racism, right, by saying that, you got to take him out, Blackjack. And in fact, Blackjack has set up this house of horrors, as they call it, right, Billy, which is filled with traps. And they're luring Shang-Chi. They've got this plan to lure him. But first, Shang-Chi, what does he do in that alley, Billy?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Oh my gosh. So those three guys, Al, Steve, and Jim, are debating back and forth about, you know, like, he doesn't look like he has any money, but let's get him anyway. All three of them kind of come at him. And Shang-Chi doesn't even look like he knows they're right behind him, but of course he does because he probably can hear them because they're idiots. And he just does this back kick where he kicks the Roy Thomas-looking character whomp and just knocks him right like back like 10 feet. It's great.
Yeah, it's amazing, man. And then we have this bit where Shang-Chi, you know, the caption boxes, of course, it's all his inner monologue or his inner thoughts saying that he's always alert. You know, he's got this sense of alertness that normal men don't have because they weren't trained continuously day after day to be continuously aware of their surroundings. But, you know, these are junkies, so it's not a great feat to beat them up. He beats up two of them and then he confronts the last, the Jim Starlin guy. And what happens, Billy?
Shang-Chi just turns around and like is in a fighting stance and the guy just says, "Not me, man, forget it," and he runs away.
He runs away, leaves his friends in the alley bleeding and bruised and battered. And then these are great panels by Starlin, or great pages by Starlin, because you've got this side by side, it's still with a split page where you've got these panels of Shang-Chi beating up the junkies, and then on the right hand side of the very same page you've got these panels running down vertically, right? Narratively, it goes vertically. Where Blackjack and Petrie are discussing how they're going to take down Shang-Chi. So they're doing it because as you might remember, listeners, Shang-Chi murdered Dr. Petrie in England. And, you know, Sir Dennis is firmly based in the UK. But now Shang-Chi traveled to New York. As it turns out, we're giving the means how he did it. We're informed that he did it on his father's private plane when he traveled after the assassination of Petrie. He traveled to New York to his father's lair, which is in the middle of New York, this giant building, right, which is all Fu Manchu. It's got a whole like a Chinatown built in this building, right? So that's how he got to the States so fast. But then Dennis Smith, he also came to the States because he knew Shang-Chi would run to the States somehow. And then he has put the bait out there by saying, well, getting the Daily Bugle, J. Jonah Jameson, and the guys to publish a story. Nayland Smith back in the U.S. And this
is
hopefully
a nice touch with the Daily Bugle there.
Yeah, he's thinking that this will draw Shang-Chi to him because he's still thinking Shang-Chi is a pawn of Fu Manchu. He wants to assassinate Smith as well, right? So he's putting himself out there as bait, but the venue will be Blackjack Tars, you know, like House of Horrors, which he's outfitted to, you know, to murder, you know, intruders.
Booby trap.
And there's also some FBI, CIA agents, I should say, on hand, because after all, Dennis Smith says that since he's a member of MI6, when he comes to the States, he has to liaise with the people from the CIA, you know, because he's on their turf. But these CIA agents prove no match for Shang-Chi, right, Billy? He just wades through them like a hot knife through butter. It's like a scythe through ripe ears of corn. Or corn stalks, I should say. But, you know, it's interesting that he finds the paper on the ground in the alley. Then he hitches a ride on a truck, on a couple of trucks, actually.
Yeah, on the back he jumps on, like delivery trucks.
That's right. Now, look at this, Billy. Now, I want you to talk about that. Then we have this brief interlude with Fu Manchu in his New York building. Now, what happens here?
That's my favorite page of the entire book. Yeah. My favorite scene, too. You have Fu Manchu, and he's got his little monkey there on his shoulder, and he's got like all these like servants and people around him and stuff like that. And his one of his main guys, is it Tak?
Yeah, or, Tak.
Yeah, he says, Tak says, "Oh, Celestial One, I have studied. I am once again prepared to battle your son, Master. Let me." Fu Manchu cuts him off. "Silence, Tak. Shang-Chi is a living weapon. You are a wrestler. Did he not overcome Midnight, who matched his prowess in the martial arts?" And it's like, yeah, dude, you're just some big goofy wrestler. You're not going to be able to take down Shang-Chi.
Well, Shang-Chi severely, you know, beat this guy severely in, you know, their first encounter in the first, you know, in special edition 15, right? But he two issues back. So
yeah,
this guy's showing confidence here, which is admirable, you know, obviously to impress his master Fu Manchu, but he's not going to last. Shang-Chi specializes in taking down opponents who are bigger and stronger than him. So, you know, but over here, you know, every single person in this Fu Manchu, you know, headquarters is unique looking, right? You've got these two business types in the background, this Asian woman and this man with this, he looks like, his name just escaped me, but Chris Christopherson. All right, do you see that guy in the background?
Oh yeah, he does.
Looks like a Chris Christopherson businessman type, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got this lady there in the background, and then you've got this little knick-knack looking guy with a little cat. You know, he's like Herve Villechaize from Man with the Golden Gun, the James Bond film, right? But he's Asian.
Looks pretty sinister there, yeah.
Yeah, he's rubbing this cat, you know, so it's like knick-knack, you know, and a bit of Blofeld, you know, in there. And then you've got this servant with this brazier. Again, the word brazier.
Oh. Yeah, I thought maybe it was like baked Alaska or something. Sure.
Flambé.
Fumancho or something, yeah.
Yeah, man, he's got that. And then he's got this servant woman bowing to him and this gong with these Chinese symbols on it. And you know, they're saying that they'll let, you know, Shang-Chi perish at the hands of Nayland Smith because he obviously recognizes this newspaper article as a trap as well. Does Fu Manchu, right? So,
yeah.
And he's saying he loves it when his enemies, you know, fight amongst themselves. So anger is my opponent's anger is my favorite weapon. That's what Fu Manchu says. Wow. And then, you know, Shang-Chi asks directions to the place where this is weird, right, Billy?
This guy, yes, cab driver.
Cab driver, yeah, man. This cab driver knows exactly because he's an undercover cop or undercover CIA operative, as it turns out, right? He points Shang-Chi in the right direction, but then Shang-Chi avoids the guards because he overheard the cop, you know, speaking into the radio, right? Or the CIA guy.
Yeah, he's talking to like a radio or walkie-talkie or something. He goes, "Chief, he's in town. Yeah, he's on his way. nah, he ain't wise. Get ready for him. And then Shang-Chi's thinking to himself, why do Americans conspirators whisper so loudly?
Yeah, the badger's heading to the honey. The badger's heading to the honey. Something.
Oh, man.
Oh, this is funny. But he gets into the house. Obviously, he was meant to get in. And then, you know, he trips a silent alarm, an invisible beam of light, as he says. And then that triggers a bell, an alarm, and then also the metal, you know, blast
steel shutters,
you know, lowers, and all the windows, all the means of escape the exits are all blocked. And then, you know, Dennis is at this console with Blackjack, and Blackjack's already, like, you know, doffed his shirt, right? He's ready for some action. He's got his chest on full display. And the CIA guys are the first, you know, meat into the grinder, as Sir Dennis says. You, it's FBI guys, right? He says, you, federal agents, take him!
And they start creeping around a hallway, like down their hallway. And Shang-Chi's already around the corner waiting for them. And hi-ya! Koom kicks like all five of them at one time and just kicks the crap out of them.
Oh man, that's a great scene. That's fantastic. That's great Starlin art there too, Billy, right?
But great panel.
It looked like, with one kick and swipes of his arms, but it's one movement. He took out five CI guys armed with guns. And then he avoid. Now this is great, Billy. This is showing you how inhumanly fast Shang-Chi is, how honed his reflexes are. He runs down the corridor, falls down a trapdoor, cleverly disguised trapdoor, and it's going to get impaled on some spikes at the bottom, right, of the shaft. But he's fast enough to extend his arms during the fall to grab hold of the sides of the edges and then do a backflip out of the trap. Whoa, that was awesome. And then
it really pisses off Nayland Smith.
Yeah, it does. But he's starting to admire Shang-Chi here, right? He's starting to say, whoa, this is insane. But dodge this, you devil. And then the chandelier crashes down on him. But he avoids that too. Because like we mentioned in the beginning, when he was in that alley, he's got this uncanny sense of situational awareness, right, Billy? Where he's continuously aware. And he's also calm at all times. Because now that he's in a room filled with gas, poison gas, and he immediately calms his heart, stills his breathing, and then concentrates and then looks for the weak spot of the room. And it turns out to be this door, which is this reinforced oak door, right? But he, with one kick, fia, crump, that door is reduced to splinters. So Billy, now look at this great Starlin face. You know, Starlin has this way of drawing faces. Look at him drawing Dennis Nyland Smith's face. It's like, let's just call him Sir Dennis. Sir Dennis's face. But Billy, what happens then? Then Shang-Chi's confronted by opponents he's never faced before.
Yeah, somehow Nyland Smith and Blackjack Tar here have these suits of armor, and they're like, basically, I guess they're just robots, but it's robotic suits of armor, and they have all this, you know, old weaponry and swords and all this stuff, and they start attacking him, and, you know, it takes him a few minutes to get adjusted because he's used to fighting people, not something like that, but he eventually, you know, gets crazy and just smashes the crap out of all of them with his bare hands.
Yeah. At first, he treats them, like you say, like his human opponents, you know. He goes for weak spots, for nerve clusters, and so forth. It doesn't work. So then he goes for the joints, right, where they're fused together. The different parts are fused together. And it seems that the weaker spot is the neck. So he, you know, uses his kung fu blows to basically decapitate them. You know, which is amazing. And, you know, then, you know, he's battered his fists against these, you know, robotic opponents. And his hands are not even bruised or bleeding. And Shang-Chi explains this in a caption box. He says his hands have been hardened by years of training. Now, anybody who's seen these kung fu videos of these kung fu masters pummeling this hot sand, right, Billy, until their hands become leather, their skin around their knuckles and so forth becomes leather tough. So this is not inconceivable at all. I mean, any guitar player can tell you, when you've played guitar, you know, when you start playing guitar and you play guitar for a couple of months, your fingers develop these calluses, right, Billy? Mm-hmm. Now, it's the same with these Kung Fu masters. They develop these calluses on their hands and fists and the edges of their palms and so forth. So, you know, Shang-Chi's got all of that and more.
Yeah, I love watching those. I've seen a lot of those videos, and I love watching them, except for when some of those crazy guys hit themselves in the balls. That's just going too far.
Yeah, they can somehow turn that off, too, the pain.
Oh, God.
That's just horrible to watch for any man. But
jeez.
But here, you know, you've got Shang-Chi taking out these robotic opponents, and then there's this great panel, I think, in this one page where when he beats the first robot opponent, Dennis Smith's face, it's agape, right, Billy? He's like, he's completely incredulous here. He's like, what? You know, this is a great Starlin image there, even though it's a very small panel.
Yeah, it's very, very thin.
But it's amazing. And then, you know, you've got them saying, Black Jack saying he's definitely going to take out Shang-Chi now because this guy's already been bruised and battered. He should be tired of facing all these opponents and traps. He's just come off his toughest, you know, test yet, fighting these three robots. And then now it's Black Jack, right? He goes to the upper level where Dennis Smith is waiting in the control room, and he encounters the full badassery of Black Jack Tar. Now, Billy, speak about this. Oh, this is great.
Yeah, he comes walking into the room, and Black Jack Tar flips on the light and says, "I am Black Jack Tar, you heathen assassin. I am the bloke who will kill you."
Yeah. Oh, man. That's some smack talking right off the bat right there from Black Jack. That seems to be his MO, right, Billy? Because he first wants to soften you up with some insults and some racism there. Racist insults.
Yeah.
And he was a British agent in Hong Kong, as it turns out. So definitely MI6 employed. And then he says, you know, all of these insults, you know, "I know the Weasley way you think and the Weasley way you fight. You know, now Chinaman, prepare for death." But, you know, yeah. Shang-Chi, what does he say, buddy? What does he think?
Well, he just remains cool, and he's trying to tell this big idiot, like, "Dude, I'm not here to fight. I just want to talk to Nayland Smith." Yeah. And yeah. And he just won't have it. He thinks he's trying to, like, double-cross him. So he just keeps going on and on and on. And finally, Shang-Chi, he talks too much. Wah! Tonk, kicks him right in the face.
Yeah, and Shang-Chi, you know, he hates talkers. If you know, that's one thing you'll notice, Billy, throughout the entire run. He's not much for talking. He is a lot for contemplating, you know, inner thoughts of Shang-Chi. The inner thoughts are always shown, you know, through these caption boxes. Kind of like Swamp Thing. You know, Swamp Thing doesn't talk much. He's sort of got most of this inner monologue running, which obviously endears you to the character, because you need a character who can speak. That's the one thing about Man-Thing, why he's not always very successful as a character. You kind of have to rely on the supporting characters of the Man-Thing stories. But Shang-Chi is definitely one of those quiet characters who hardly ever speaks, but they've got this deep inner life that's worth narrating.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, like, kicks him in the face then. And then there's some great Kung Fu action on Shang-Chi's part. He's got this pattern of movements that he's planned out to beat Black Jack Tar, right? Billy gives him an elbow to the head, and then he gives him a knee to the face again, to the chin. But all of that proves ineffective, because what happens?
Yeah, after he knees him in the chin there, Black Jack Tar just comes right back with, like, a right cross or a right hook there, and boom, and he knocks Shang-Chi down, and he says, "I'm like the oak, boy. Strike me with all your might. And strike me with all your might for all the day, and you will only bruise your hands." And he starts getting ready to kick the crap out of him. But then, you know, like I said, Shang-Chi's pretty smart and pretty tough. So he grabs his arm. He's going to do a toss, and it tosses him right off of the balcony into the bottom floor.
Yeah. He tosses him through the balcony, you know, the railing. Through the banister there, and then he smashes down onto the floor. But he survived, right, Billy? That's like a three-story drop, at least, maybe even more.
Mm-hmm.
But he's just dazed. But the sound when he hits the floor is great. Bunt.
Yeah, maybe like 20 feet. So he hits the floor, but he doesn't. Like you say, he doesn't die, and he looks like he's actually trying to get back up. But Shang-Chi just blows him off to go find Nayland Smith.
Now, this meeting with Nayland Smith is also great, I believe. Smith's waiting behind the door with a dagger ready to be thrown. Shang-Chi is aware of that because he can sense Nayland Smith behind the door. So what does he do?
Yeah, he kind of backs up a few feet before the door there and goes to the point where there's like a little window where he's like waiting with this dagger, puts his fist right through and knocks the dagger out of his hand.
Exactly, man. Through the door, punches through the door, and the dagger goes flying. And then, you know, the only recourse Smith has is to resort to words, right? And he says that, okay, so you've defeated all the traps. You've defeated Black Jack Tar. Now you're face to face with me. So go ahead and murder me. I mean, your father's already done worse to me than death, you know, and he shows him the leg again. He's already showed him the legs before. That's like, you know, one of his go-to moves, right? Here's a reminder.
Yeah.
In, you know, after Petrie's death, yeah, he already did that. And he says, I'm a cripple. But then Shang-Chi has an insight. I don't know how he knows this, right, Billy? But he uses, rather, he came here for wisdom from Dennis Nyland Smith. He wanted to find out what should he do now? Should he turn himself into the authorities? Should he submit to Western law after committing crimes? Or should he continue to take the fight to his father? And he was hoping, I think, subconsciously to get an ally here. And he will eventually. But, you know, right now it's too early. I mean, fresh off of the murder of Petrie. So Dennis Smith's not going to accept Shang-Chi yet. But Shang-Chi does something incredible here for Smith. He makes Smith realize that his inability to walk and to recover from these horrific injuries is solely psychological, right, Billy? It's psychosomatic.
Yeah.
That he can't walk. That's the reason.
Mm-hmm.
So what does he do? Mm-hmm. He browbeats him a little. But he also shames him. He shames him into standing. He says, like, you know, you are your worst enemy. It's not me. It's not Fu Manchu. It's what Fu Manchu has done to you. You know, like, he's made you believe you're a cripple. And that's the worst injury of all. The injury that Nayland Smith inflicted on himself.
Yeah. Mentally. His mind and his, like, you know, emotions. Yeah.
Mm. Now I love the fact that Shang-Chi also ties this to his hate. His hatred of Shang-Chi, his hatred of Fu Manchu. That's the hatred, that's the knot that prevents Nayland Smith from, you know, undoing this knot that will allow him to finally walk again. So in fact he does let go of his hatred. Right, somehow. But like I say, Shang-Chi has to shame him into doing this. Because rather than now killing him, Shang-Chi rather, you know, like, sort of talks to him. And that's not what he's expecting, you know, Nayland Smith. So, well, basically, Shang-Chi first says he would rather see Nayland Smith stand. And then Nayland Smith takes that as a insult, right? Because he's saying that, oh, you want me to fall down. You want me to crawl at your feet ignominiously, right? But Shang-Chi's literally saying that you can do it. Now, how he knows that, Billy, I don't know, right? But maybe Shang-Chi is privy to that kind of Eastern philosophy where they say that mind over matter, you know, kind of like your mind can accomplish, you know, wonders. Now, I don't always believe that, but, you know, I mean, there's definitely limits to the mind. There's limits to everything. But, of course, there are placebos, you know, the belief that something is working and then it actually has an impact on the physical world. That does happen, but there are limits to that. But this seems to be Dennis Smith's, why he was holding himself back. And then he does stand. And then Shang-Chi, with one sentence, he seals the deal here. He says, like, have you ever thought you would succeed? You know, so he never believed in himself enough to think that he would be able to stand. And then he does, right, Billy? Now, you know what the funny thing is? The way Starlin draws Dennis Smith here, it looks like the way Starlin looks now.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it looks like Starlin now.
Doesn't it look like that? It's even got his style of clothing. I mean, Starlin these days, he still dresses in the 70s style, you know, sometimes. When he shows up at cons, at least from what I've seen on YouTube and so forth. But, you know, this is interesting because there's this great sequence of panels where he forces himself up out of this chair. And Shang-Chi then says, you know, you stand even though you knew you could not. And then he ends with this great line. Billy, you want to read that last sequence of panels that Shang-Chi mentions there. This is some great what would you call it, like philosophizing.
Yeah, great fortune cookie here. He says, what one knows, Sir Dennis, is not always the truth. Think on what you know of me till next we meet. And then it says, next, the alliance. And it has Smith there looking out the window into the dark.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a great... But this is the first step towards Shang-Chi, you know, becoming more than just an enemy of Nayland Smith. This is Nayland Smith at first... Of course, first he would think that, okay, Shang-Chi did not kill him, meaning that he somehow turned against his father. And then he's going to think, how can I use this against Fu Manchu? How can I use Shang-Chi as my personal weapon against and turn Fu Manchu's son even further against him? So that's the way Dennis Smith thought at first. But eventually he would grow to love Shang-Chi, you know, to see him as a son, a surrogate son. But, you know, Billy, now we've got a bit of a teaser here for the patrons, because next is the debut on Master of Kung Fu of Paul Gulacy. He's gonna be doing the art. Now, of course, we're sad Jim Starlin departs. But, you know, I've never associated Jim Starlin with a martial arts, you know, kind of artist. Paul Gulacy, on the other hand, he draws even better than Starlin when it comes to the martial arts action scenes. Now, action scenes, Starlin has it better than most people, right? He can draw fantastic action. But now you're going to see what Paul Gulacy can do with this character. Look forward to that, patrons, as we get into the next time we'll talk about Master of Kung Fu 18, where Engelhardt and Gulacy team up. So, Billy, great issue, right? What did you think? What's your final thoughts?
Yeah, overall, great issue. Pacing and the writing, the action, everything, you know, Starlin's artwork with Milgram inking, it looks great. I wonder too, when did they, because they had quite a long partnership, Starlin and Milgram. I wonder if this was their first collaboration, because this is pretty early on.
Yeah, this is early on, very early on. You know, I think not the first collaboration they might have had, but we can check up on that. I think this is, you know, second or third at least, you know. Third maybe. Because, Al Milgram and they would go on to become, you know, like you say, collaborators, but also very good friends. They might have been friends already here. But I know firmly that Starlin was hanging out a lot with Engelhardt, in the beginning here. And, they were best friends for a while there at Marvel. But eventually, you know, they went their separate ways. But no enmity between them. But then, you know, I'd say Milgram, I would associate him more with collaborating with Starlin. Later on. But Starlin also a standalone, you know, creator. He doesn't really need a lot of collaborators. At one point in time, he just broke loose, right, Billy? Like during his Warlock run, and then his run on Captain Marvel for Marvel Comics, and then eventually, of course, when he started to do his own creator-owned projects like Dreadstar and stuff like Breed and fantastic when he's on his own as well. Then he's unfettered. I love Starlin when he's like that, you know.
Right.
But here it's still under the yoke of Marvel Editorial. but they were already doing their own thing. You know, they were like the young guns and they were rebels and they were working behind the scenes, you know, to do what they wanted to do, to draw what they wanted to draw. And I think Marvel Editorial largely let them do what they, you know, what they wished, because after all, they were only worried about the big titles, the big sellers, you know, the Fantastic Fours, the Avengers, you know, they were letting these guys do what they wanted on these newer titles, right?
They had a lot of latitude.
Yeah, but already early on, Master of Kung Fu proved very successful sales-wise. You know, the first issue rivaled the sales of the titles like Doctor Strange. And also titles like, you know, Fantastic Four after Kirby left. And then, of course, you know, eventually it would rise even higher than most of the regular series. You know, so Master of Kung Fu, highly successful. Definitely more successful than Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, and Iron Fist was, even though they sold really well, too. Really well. Yeah. So we'll get to some more goodness during next month, listeners, with Shang-Chi. But right now, we're heading off to Harlem and a certain movie theater we discussed and a certain badass jive-talking guy you don't want to mess with, and that's Luke Cage here, starring in Hero for Hire issue 3. Okay, Billy, before we get to synopsis, I'll give a rundown on the credits here. We have the title of the story in Hero for Hire 3, Mark of the Mace. And it's 20 pages, cover art by Billy Graham, edited by Roy Thomas. It was cover dated October 1972, but on sale July 1972. And of course, the creative team here, writer Archie Goodwin, penciler George Tuska, inked by Billy Graham, the cover artist, and then lettered by John Constanza. And of course, you can find this in the newest Luke Cage collection, which is called Retribution, right, Billy? That's the one you have.
Yeah, real nice book.
Really nice. It's thick. I think it has like 16 or so issues or more even, right, Billy, at least.
It's Hero for Hire, 1 through 16, and Power Man 17 to 23.
So more than 16. Whoa, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. And then, well, that means if they, let's say they print another one of those to follow up on that one, they would cover the entire Power Man run then. And then, you know, just in time to have Iron Fist and Power Man team up, because that happened in issue 50 of the Power Man series when it merged with Iron Fist. So another one, and that should complete the entire Power Man, you know, volume one, which is good. The Hero for Hire stuff. So Billy, though, great cover here by Billy Graham. We've got a fantastic creative team. And then, of course, I'm reading it in the Masterworks, Luke Cage Masterworks, which, you know, is pretty good. And then you can also find it, of course, same as you could find the Shang-Chi stuff in the Marvel app or also on Comixology. And, of course, Shang-Chi has those omnibuy that are now hard to find. They're still available on eBay, but they're very pricey. So you pay like $100 or more bucks for one, you know,
crazy
more than that, but worth getting, definitely. And Luke this time around, he's got a you know, an opponent who's got another gimmick. You know, in the previous issues, Willis Stryker had his knives, the exploding knives. This time around, we've got a guy called Mace, and he actually has a mace for a hand.
I love it.
But it's gonna be great, man. You can see this on the cover already. So, Billy, what's your synopsis for Hero for Hire number 3?
All right, here we go. After the demise of Diamondback, Luke confronts Dr. Bernstein. An argument ensues, but after Luke makes a Disney reference, all's good. What's on the horizon for Mr. Cage, you ask? The man called Mace.
Nice one, Billy. Nice one, man. Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does make a Disney reference there.
I'm thinking that's kind of funny.
Oh, that is weird. Well, eventually we get owned by Disney, so but still. Okay, so mine goes as follows. Luke jives with Doc Bernstein, then gets hired by one Owen Ridgely to stop a militant group planning the takeover of Manhattan. Led by Vietnam vet Gideon Mace, hitmen mess up Luke's digs, and then it's on. The turkeys get beat. Luke and Mace take a dive into the East River in a helicopter. So you can see this all on the cover, in fact. I'm not giving too much away yet.
No, yeah, it's all there.
But it's fantastic Billy Graham cover there, right, Billy?
Oh, it's great.
By your namesake.
Yeah, and you're going to get a good preview, because he's going to eventually take over the art duties for a little while by himself, and it's great stuff.
Yes. Oh, this is amazing. I love the way he draws Luke's torso, you know, the musculature, but also the collarbones, the detail in the muscles there, the shadows. I like the way he shades. And he also has, you know, this great way of drawing faces. Look at Mace's face. It's like,
yeah,
almost
he looks
like
really
a
crazy
Sal Buscema face there, but yeah, but you know, unique enough to be called completely a Graham face. You know, Mace is his name. Murder is his game. Now, I don't know how Luke's holding on to that helicopter there, right, Billy? But it looks like it's plummeting downward, so he's obviously got some kind of a foothold. But it's weird, right? I mean, I don't know how Mace is leaning out of that window, shooting Luke in the back there, but somehow it's just a great image. And Luke just pulverizing this back rotor of this helicopter. And I'm always a fan of the corner box of the Hero for Hire title. Luke, you know, standing in this pose, shouting at the man.
Pissed off, yeah.
Yeah, I love it. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. But, you know, Luke was never a character who took on the white establishment. He wasn't, I shouldn't say that all the time, referencing the man. I'm just saying that, you know, he's an everyman, actually. You know, he takes, mm-hmm. he's someone you can identify with. He's, yeah. You know, he takes cases from every corner of the social stratum. He doesn't really have favorites. He doesn't show favoritism towards the black people in need. You know, he's firmly a character not fighting racism. He is an example of, you know, a black man who is a hero. And
yeah.
we shouldn't look at people in black and white anymore, right, Billy? And mm-hmm. that's what I like about the Luke Cage title. Of course, there were some issues that dealt with that. But essentially, Luke Cage is about showing that, hey, you know, there's no difference between any of us. You know, a hero mm-hmm. is a hero, whether it's Superman or whether it's Power Man.
Yeah, and for that's, sure. That's absolutely.
That's why eventually I liked it when they gave him the name Power Man. You know, because... Yeah. And they also upped his strength levels. You know, Billy, in these early issues, he's powerful. But he could, for instance, take on Spider-Man. He's got Spider-Man level strength. You know, so according mm-hmm. to the Marvel handbook, let's say 15 to 20 tons, you know, that he could bench press or something. Spider-Man can do roughly that as well. But, you know, later on they would up his power where he would be able to pick up huge weights and he would be able to be almost as invulnerable as the Hulk, you know, with yeah. his steel-like skin. But here he gets bruised if he gets hit by high-caliber rounds. Later on he would shrug them off without bruises. So I liked it that Luke became more powerful as time went by, you know. And they mm-hmm. literally made him a power man. So much so that when I was a kid, Billy, I was associating Luke in the same weight class as Thor, the Hulk, the Thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but there are really issues of Power Man and Iron Fist where he shows that. I mean, there's one issue where he fights the Mole Man and they collapse this mountain on top of him. You know, and then with the mountains mm-hmm. falling towards him in free fall. Well, it's not a mountain. It's like a mini mountain. But, you know, it weighs at least... upwards of 200 tons, this massive rock, and Luke just takes it out with one punch, you know, before it hits him. And then he picks up a trailer, you know,
gosh.
You know, to scare away these folks who were like striking. There, you know, the strike had turned violent. Luke goes, yeah. he picks up a truck. Now we're talking about a full blown, truck here. You know,
like 40 tons,
a 40
yeah.
tons truck. And he hefts it over his head to scare these folks away. So, you know, really Luke changed, you know, as time went by. He became more of a, you know, a powerful hero in his own right. But here he was very much like, I don't know, you wouldn't say he was more powerful than someone like, you know, in strength levels than Spider-Man or, you know, or like that, you know. So still very enjoyable. And so, Billy, the story mm-hmm. starts us off right at the end of the previous tale where Willis had died, and then you got the cops showing up on this rooftop, and you still got this fire from the skylight where Willis perished, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wafting out. And then Claire Temple shows up, and she talks the cops down. She says, "This is the man who saved me. He freed me from Stryker." And then the cops are very nice to Luke, because it seems that they're used to dealing with heroes, you know, this being the Marvel Universe, New York, right, Billy?
Right.
Unless it's Spider-Man. You know?
Well, you know, he's a menace.
Tried to arrest him. Yeah, thanks, Jonah. J. Jonah Jameson. But, you know, Luke heads off to speak to Doc Bernstein because he wants to know the guy's plan. Because after all, only the Doc knows that he's ex-con. Well, he's not ex-con. He's still a man that's presumed dead. But if people know he's alive, he would send right back to the clink. And he used mm-hmm. to be Lucas, right? So
mm-hmm.
he wants to know what Doc Bernstein's going to do. And at first, it seems that the Doc is going to call the cops and he's going to turn him in. But what happens then, Billy?
Yeah, he decides not to because he thinks it's better off if, you know, I don't say have a partnership, but, you know, Luke Cage kind of flips out on him, but Dr. Bernstein kind of just does think to himself, like, you know, hey, you know, I'm part of this because my crazy experiment messed him up, but he's trying to do some good here. So, you know, how about we almost, like I said, almost have like a partnership where you go out and do your thing and I'm going to kind of keep an eye on you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, his life's work had been destroyed, but now he's seen that his life's work has actually turned out to have done some good. You know, Luke turning to the side of good. The only thing he has a gripe with, right, Billy, is Luke charging people for help, which, then Luke explains that like his whole life, he's been, you know, hunted, he's been hounded, he's never gotten anything served on a platter. It's time that the world started to pay him, you know, he started to see some dividends, and he's doing good, but he expects to get compensated for that. But, you know, as we find out in this issue, Billy, that's not what Luke's about at all. He has to make a living, but we'll see at the end of this issue, he has a heart of gold, you know.
Yeah, he's really more about helping people than he is anything else.
Yeah, now look at this, Billy. You've got these great scenes of Harlem here, right? While they're talking, Doc Bernstein explains that he opened up this private practice with Claire because he wants to help people after the experiment failed, and he blamed himself for Lucas's death. And he's helping the black community here. He's a doctor for the black community. They show his patients sitting out in the hallway. And then outside the windows of the clinic, they show these two... This black couple making out, the silhouette of them, right? That is just, there's no reason to put that in there, but, you know, Tuska put that in. It's great. And, you know, it shows that, you know, the human side of the black community there, and I love it. And, and then, you know, Luke, he says he's, you know, more, baby. You want to change it? Try. But don't expect me to hang around yelling right on, you know? So, He says, you know, just I'll just let the chips fall where they may. And of course, then he heads out in a huff, slams the door. Claire tries to stop him. She can't. But basically, Luke says that, you know, he doesn't like Doc Bernstein looking over his shoulder. Right, Billy? Because this is essentially what the doc said he would do. He's saying like, okay, Lucas, I won't turn you into the cops, but I'll be keeping my eye on you.
So, yeah, and then Cage says, like a parole officer.
Yeah.
And Dr. Bernstein says, or maybe a conscience. And he's like,
this is
my
great.
Own private conscience, huh? That's just fine. If I was Pinocchio and you were Jiminy Cricket.
Another, Disney reference here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, sort of. I mean,
you know, I love it.
It's great. It's great. So then, you know, we cut to the villain of the issue, right, Billy? We've got this great scene where he's introduced, just his hand, his gloved hand, his left hand, which is the only hand he has, holding up this toy soldier, I think it is, or it could just be a model of a soldier, and he puts it on this board, which is obviously they're strategizing something, and it turns out this is one Gideon Mace, ex-Vietnam vet turned militant radical, who's now planning a takeover of Manhattan with his own private army, right? This mercenary army he's employed. And he's got a couple of bad-looking hoods, right, working for him there. They're not hoods. They're the bad-looking ex-soldiers there, right, Billy? But look at this, that bald guy with the bandage, the Band-Aid on his head. You've got this guy, this white guy with his afro and this Charles Bronson look on his face with his mustache. You've got this blonde guy smoking a cigarette, Chuck Norris-looking guy. he's got a crew. That's just the leaders of his private army. He's got, like, more than that. But then, you know, one of the guys, this Ridgely guy, he makes a run for it because he's one of the mercenary recruits, the ex-vets, the veterans, the ex-soldiers. And he decided, no, he's not going to go along with this crazy plan of taking over Manhattan. It's going to result in some serious loss of life. So he runs away from this guy, Gideon Mace, who's got this mace that he's just used to smash this little model of the soldier. And then this guy Ridgely runs to Cage. And somehow he got a hold of Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, the card that Luke's been distributing, you know, in Harlem, the business card. And then this guy's tired out of his mind. Luke puts him up on his sofa and says, DW, you know, sorry, man, you gotta give me some time. I gotta talk business with this guy, right? So as he's talking about this Ridgely guy, before they can get into it, right, Billy, someone has been hunting this Ridgely, and he accosts DW with a, what is that, a Luger or something? it's a weird sci-fi
pistol.
Pistol, yeah. So while DW is being manhandled downstairs or held at gunpoint, this Ridgely guy explains the whole situation about he's got a wife and son, but he left to go serve in Vietnam. He came back. He couldn't get a job. You know, Billy, this is now George Tuska and Billy Graham and, of course, Archie Goodwin espousing the plight of many Vietnam vets. Now, you probably know more about this than me. But America had no support system for veterans returning from the war to get them back integrated back into society. At least that's what I've read. And many countries, of course, have the same who engage in foreign wars. But, you know, the veterans are not respected. I mean, people think that, you know, especially from the Vietnam War. Of course, World War II veterans are well respected. But Vietnam War vets, you know, they were two camps. You know, one camp... you know, praised them, another camp vilified them as baby killers and whatnot, you know, so horrible, really, what they suffered and what they had to go through and against their will, you know, Billy, they didn't have a choice, they were drafted. So, you know, this guy, Ridgely, he's firmly one of these characters. And then he meets up with his old buddies and they, you know, tell him about this militant group run by this guy called Mace. And as it turned out, he's really named Gideon Mace, and he has a mace for a hand. Whoa, go figure. So then, you know, he quits and runs to Cage. And what happens at Cage's digs? DW shows up at the door, but there's a bit of a secret code that DW gives to Luke, right, Billy? Did you catch that?
Yeah, it's funny. He goes in there, and it's funny. He goes, what does he say? Great having a fellow night owl in the building, Cage. Always like rapping when I'm done cleaning Uncle Max's eye strain emporium. And then he's like, cool it, DW. Somebody's coming up the stairs fast. Oh, I'm sorry. Before that, he said, too bad the Orange Julius stand is closed.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this is where the code comes in, right? They were talking about the Orange Julius stand. And there's no way that they can get anything from there. And then when the guy shows up holding DW at gunpoint, wanting to force entry or to surprise Cage by letting Cage come out, and DW gives a bit of a code there, right? He says that, hey, man, you sent me to the Orange Julius stand, and I'm back with the stuff you wanted. Let me in before the taco dogs get cold. And then Cage knows that this is code from DW because the Orange Julius stand's closed. And then he theorized that, hey, if I was someone holding DW, you know, against his will, I would have DW in front of the door and the guys would be on either side, right? So what does he do, Billy Cage?
He gets a head of steam running and comes flying up to the wall and drop kicks his way right through the wall and kicks the crap out of the guy on the other side.
Now, this guy's back must be broken, Billy. I mean, he is taken out of the fight. We never see any more of him. But the bald guy with the Band-Aid on his head, he gets off a couple of shots. Three shots straight at Cage's midriff. Nothing happens. Cage says, cool it, skinhead. You're hidden all right, baby. But so am I. And then he says, since I'm the cat with the cast iron hide, you and that Mauser come up losers, right? And then he beats this guy with this swipe of his fist down the stairs. This guy caroms off the steps. But then there's the sound of gunfire in his office. Brrp. Some kind of a Uzi, right? And it turns out Ridgely's been assassinated. Well, he's still alive, but the assassin's escaping through the back window. So there were three guys, right, Billy? Cage gives chase. He smashes through the window, but then this guy with his Uzi, or it's some kind of a submachine gun, right?
He
discharges an entire clip into Cage's stomach. And Luke's, hurt, but obviously just bruised. He's fine, but his shirt's torn like it always gets torn in every single comic. And then Luke rips off this fire escape, right? Which the guy was
fire climbing. Fire escape.
Yeah. And the guy plummets to his death. Right, Billy. So this is Cage is a character that he maims, he breaks bones, but he also kills, you know, at times. I mean, Willis died. He didn't directly kill Willis. Willis died from his own incompetence, I think, or from his own bad luck. But Cage does frequently. I mean, this is not the last opponent who's going to perish in this comic book, right, Billy?
No, not for sure.
Yeah, so this guy plummets to his death after Luke pulled him off the fire escape. And then Luke heads back just in time to see Ridgely dying, but he gives Luke a ton of cash and says, listen, I'm hiring you to take down Mace. You know, so you'd have thought that, okay, he would have also left a message for his wife and kid, but he didn't have time, I guess.
No.
So he's broken. Yeah. He drops this money at Luke's feet, and then Luke's hired. He's hired, baby. He's going to take out this Mace character. So, Billy, now speak on the next sequence. They're gearing up for the Manhattan invasion over at Mace's compound, which seems to be a mansion of some sort. It reminds me of Tony Montana's, you know, Scarface's residence, right?
Yeah.
Say hello to my little Mace.
Yeah. He's got, like I said, this crazy huge house, a chopper, trucks, all this manpower. So he's definitely got some resources from doing some kind of business.
Well, no, he says he's rich, right? He had an inheritance or something. The Mace family fortune, he references that one time. But yeah, definitely some kind of a mansion. But he's turned it into a compound of some kind. It doesn't look like your typical mansion, you know. It's definitely like almost like a fortress. But this doesn't stop Luke from plowing a car straight through his living room window.
After he accosts the driver of the car and calls him Baldy.
Yes, that's the same guy you hurled down the stairs. And he kicks him out of the car at 60 miles an hour. Yeah, and the guy falls on his head, Billy.
Yeah, he's probably not with us anymore.
Oh, yeah, he's dead. The guy on the got his back broken by being drop-kicked through the wall is dead, I'm sure, and the guy that fell off the fire escape. So this is three dead guys, Luke. And then, you know, while he's in the living room, after he plowed through the window, he's again assaulted by gunfire, but it just bounces off of his chest. And then he rips off the car door, right, Billy, and he hurls it at this gunman. Now, have you ever think about it, Billy. You get hit by a car door hurled with super strength. You're also going to get some serious injury. But this guy looks like he was hit in the neck or at least in the upper chest. So now a car door is heavy. Right, that's like 120 pounds,
probably
more. 100. Yeah, 100 pounds, maybe even. So then Luke, with one swipe of his fist, takes out two guys at once, and then Gideon Mace, you know, he's impressed. He says, "Remarkable, right? Remarkable." That's the comment he gives when he looks at Cage. But then we see where military training or where personal combat training goes a long way, right, Billy? Because what happens here?
Yeah, Mace gets the better of him and starts kicking the crap out of Cage.
With his mace,
then one of his with the mace. And then one of his goons comes in and interrupts it. And that gives Cage a chance to throw a right hand, and he cracks him.
That's right. And that's where Mace sees that he's up against a superhuman opponent. Because Luke was taking the blows. He wasn't getting injured from the blows, but Mace was giving him quite a run for his money, right? Because he was just relentless, pounding Luke, pounding him into the ground. But Luke survived and then punched Mace twice, right? And that's when Mace realizes, oh, man, he can't survive another punch from Luke. So then, Billy, we get to something that's completely ridiculous. But, you know, this Mace guy being called Mace and then replacing his lost hand that he lost in Vietnam with the Mace, you know, what would he also have as a backup weapon in his Mace? Can you tell us?
Yeah, chemical mace.
Chemical mace that he sprays in Luke's face. And then Luke's eyes are burning. And then with one massive forearm swipe of the mace, he doesn't take out Luke, but he hits him hard enough to send him flying through a wall into the kitchen fortuitously, right? Because what is in the kitchen that can help against the burning mace in his eyes?
Wash his eyes out in the sink and then comes crashing out of a second story window.
Now, Billy, don't you just love the way Tuska draws Luke leaping? Think when he crashes through that window, this is the distinctive Tuska leap, right? He did the same when he leapt at the wall. He's done it a couple of times previously. One time in the very first issue of Hero for Hire, he leapt and kicked a guy in the face through a hedge or something, or like a wooden fence. While his pal Willis was getting beaten up, and it seems like Tuska loves to draw Luke leaping. You know, he's not just going to be a tank-like character firmly based on the ground. He's very agile.
Yeah.
But then he heads towards the copter where Mace is planning to take off. Luke's catching up with him. Mace hurls a grenade at Luke's feet. Now, Luke has not tested his invulnerability to the extremes yet, right, Billy? So he's worried about this grenade. So he jumps. The grenade throws him into the air, but he's fine. And then he leaps and he grabs a hold of the copter, right? The helicopter.
Chopper.
Yeah, the chopper. So Mace is... He's completely... He's at a loss for words. He doesn't know what to do now because he's thrown everything he has at Luke. And Luke just keeps coming. And then Luke administers the death blow here when he decides to take his rage out on the rotor. And what does he do, Billy? With one smash of his fist, this rotor is scrap metal. Yeah, and then there's some spectators, some rubberneckers, right? Billy, this kid and his dad and the mom, presumably, saying, the chopper dad is falling. The propeller flew apart. And then, boosh, into the Hudson, right, Billy? Now, is the Hudson and the East River the same thing? I'm not sure.
Maybe not. I thought they were separate.
Okay, yeah. So the Hudson River. So I have to amend that because in my synopsis, I said it's the East River. Plows into the Hudson River there, and Mace then finds out a little something that he didn't bargain for. And what is that, Billy?
Yeah, I mean, Mace, he goes flying into the water just like Cage. And it says, Colonel Gideon Mace, U.S. Army retired, a strong man, a hard man, disciplined, tough, a man who has devoted years to perfecting his deadly skill with a brutal, massive weapon he chose to replace a missing hand, but who has never tried to swim with it before. You just see him going down.
You see, that's it. His weapon turned out to be his weakness, too, his Achilles heel. Water, well, you know, this mace is so heavy, he can't swim with it. So, Billy, the similar thing happened to Willis Stryker. His weapon was turned against him, but not by Luke, really. Indirectly. He died from his mace, just like Willis died from one of his trick knives. And then we've got this great panel. Billy, I don't know about you, but I just love this panel where Luke walks out of the water and looks back and he sees the ripples where Gideon Mace perished in the water. And then he talks to the ghost of Owen Ridgely, presumably, when he says, "Okay, Ridgely, I wish I'd been more help to you personally, but I guess I've earned that money you gave me." But then he starts to feel bad because he repeats himself. He says, "I guess," right? And then just trails off. And then what happens at the end, Billy? This is now where I mean, I loved Luke Cage from his very first appearance when I was reading him as a kid, but this is where I really started to dig this bad man. What does he do there in the final three panels?
The guy who was at DW says damage repairs are almost done, Cage. Not sure if I can get Uncle Max to stand still for all of them though. But with the bread you got for this last case, guess it's no problem, huh? And he says, "Yeah, all that bread. We'll work something out." And then as he's walking down the street, some guy says, "Hey, there's no return address in this letter." And he's like, "No sweat, I know where it's from. Later, brother." And he said about Dr. Bernstein, "I think his big conscience rap got me."
Yeah, yeah. So what he did was all that money that Ridgely gave him before he died, he took that big wad of cash and just put it in a letter, mailed it to Ridgely's wife and his kid. You know, so the money that he was paid to, you know, Ridgely hired him to take down Mace, he just gave right back to Ridgely's wife and kid. Very nice of you, Luke. And that's where we learn that Luke does have a soul, right, Billy? He cares about people. He cares about the neighborhood, but he cares about humanity. And we're going to see that cropping up time and time again. So the jobs Luke's going to take it's not going to be superhero-based. It's going to be more bodyguards. And then, you know, he has to take out a supervillain. But the jobs are going to be legitimate jobs that someone would be able to take if you were physically imposing, you know. So it's not going to be you're going to see Luke as a character who's you know, doing a job, but he's also, you know, taking on villains when it's threatening his neighborhood. Except for that time, Billy, I don't know if you ever read that Spider-Man issue. I think it's Spider-Man 124 or something. I can't remember. But it's where J. Jonah Jameson hires Luke Cage to take out Spider-Man.
Oh,
man. But that was a great fight. I think that was Gil Kane.
Yeah.
Penciling. And, you know, I'm not a Kane fan, but that was a great Kane issue. Damn, I've never seen such a good... That's one of Spidey's best fights, I think, is him versus Cage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so,
for real.
You know, great issue, Billy. So far, it's still hard for me to pick between the Shang-Chi issue and this Luke Cage issue, but both are pretty awesome and fantastic stories and art on both counts. So, Billy, now we get to
they're both, like, top-notch.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So now we get to the bit of the dark horse of the bunch of the three issues. The last two issues of Iron Fist were also... The first issue was amazing. The first issue, you know, but still not our favorite of the bunch. The second issue of Iron Fist we discussed during our last month's batch of episodes, also not that great. But this one, I think, is the lowest of the three that we've done so far. The Iron Fist issues particularly, right? What would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It's just a little, you know, like we said, plain, a little too...
Milquetoast, lukewarm, boring. Similar to
not
the...
Not enough happening.
Yeah. Very similar to the Shang-Chi issue. You know, it's him, Iron Fist, looking for Robert Meacham, who murdered his dad, and he went to Meacham Industries, and then this entire building is outfitted as this giant, you know, trap, you know, full of booby traps, just for Iron Fist to kill him off. And he overcomes them all, but finally makes it to the upper room. And when he's ready to confront Meacham, it turns out to be this guy called Triple Iron who's waiting there for him to take him out. So, you know, why is the issue boring? It's filled with action. So it's definitely not boring on that front. It's boring because nothing much happens story-wise. You know, it's just an issue showcasing Danny's skills. So not much there, right, Billy? But we'll start off with the credits here. Of course, this is Marvel Premiere, still number 17, cover dated September 1974, but on sale June 1974, and it's cover by Gil Kane and Dick Giordano, and the title of the story is Citadel on the Edge of Vengeance, which is a pretty good title, I think, because it's apt. You know, he's invading the Citadel of Meacham, but it's, you know, for vengeance sake. And then, you know, writer Doug Munch, penciled by Larry Hama, inked by Dick Giordano, lettered by Artie Simek, and colored by Petra Goldberg. And then this can be found, of course, in the Iron Fist Masterworks, The Essential Iron Fist, and also in the Iron Fist... collections recently, the paperback collections reprinted by Marvel. I'm not calling them epic collections, but they reprinted the Iron Fist Tales. But like we're saying, once we get to Byrne and Claremont, then things will pick up, Billy. But this issue, very, very run-of-the-mill kind of superhero action. So what's your synopsis for this one?
Okay, so Iron Fist is ready to deal out some vengeance on the man that killed his father 10 years ago. First, he must fight a bunch of guys... a ninja, and a wolf.
Yeah, there's a wolf in there. And you know, the wolf was inserted there on purpose because Meacham knew somehow, I think, that his mother had perished, you know, by wolves.
Wolves eating her.
Yeah. Somehow he knew that. So this was like an ironic, you know, attempt on Meacham's part. But, you know, mine goes as follows, Billy. Danny enters Meacham Industries, finds it decked out in traps that'll put Jack Black Tar's House of Horrors to shame. Plowing through hordes of lethal assassins, including a samurai with a mop, Danny makes it to the top to find the man they call Triple Iron cooling his heels. So, you know, yeah, I mean, one of the guys he had to fight was this samurai guy who was pretending to be a janitor. And then he pulled this... Ogami Ito style samurai blade out of his mop handle. Oh man, that was so funny. Iron Fist took him out in 2 seconds flat, but still, that guy was set up to be a badass. Never came to fruition there. So Billy, now, okay, we can run through this issue very quickly. What happens? I mean, opening splash page, not much. It's just Meacham in the background, you know, Meacham's face against the sky. You know, and the Harold, what is called Meacham Industries Citadel in the front with this giant M on the top, putting McDonald's M to shame. And then you've got Iron Fist just walking straight into this building. No security stops him. No secretaries reported. Well, they've obviously reported him, but, you know, he just walks in. First floor, no problem. And he meets him Industries on the 20th floor. He heads up and then reminisces, thinks back on, you know, the past and how Meacham's responsible for all the misery in his life. So, Billy, the first couple of traps, very Indiana Jones-esque, right?
Yeah. There's a bunch of spikes that come out of the wall.
That's right.
Trying to squish him and kill him, and then some machine guns.
Yeah, machine guns. He dodges the bullets, showing he's very fast, unnaturally fast, like Shang-Chi level fast. He takes out the machine guns, and then he goes into an office where Meacham's name is on the door, but when he opens the office, it's a stairwell. So, you know, he figures there might be another trap, so he tosses this piece of broken gun butt machinery or something at this stairwell, and it turns out there's, like, lasers or a cascade. What was it? Like, nozzle spurt car skating ribbons of destructive energy? Whoa. And they vaporize this little pylon that he tossed in there, but he punches through the wall panel and rips out the cords or the electrical wires. So he's free to ascend the staircase, and then the staircase is set to collapse, right? And then he takes out these hoodlum types with guns. Again, he dodges the bullets, right, Billy, which is very impressive. Captain America style. There are just a few characters in the Marvel Universe who can dodge bullets. Actually, all of them can if they really want to. But, you know, Cap does it on a regular basis. He either blocks it with his shield or he dodges the bullets. In fact, Brubaker, do you remember, Billy, Ed Brubaker's run that you and I so love with the Winter Soldier storyline, explained it. Yeah. He said that the Super Soldier Serum allows Cap to also have superhuman reflexes. You know, so he, you know, because he can superhumanly perceive things at a rate that we cannot, he actually can see the bullets coming towards him, almost like the Flash, but not at that extreme, you know, level of speed. But you know what I mean. It was explained that that's why he can dodge bullets, Cap.
Right.
And Spider-Man can do that through his spider sense and his reflexes, but Iron Fist and Shang-Chi seem to do that through their training, you know, through their reflexes being enhanced by years and years of training. So then he almost, you know, falls out of the building when the one door is tricked out to be actually a window opening onto the street 20 stories below, right, Billy? Smashes through this one window, climbs up, scales the wall, and then he gets to the ninja. But the ninja doesn't attack. In fact, the ninja prefers to first let the floor do his job. You know, he almost... In fact, I don't know what happened to that ninja. The ninja was just the guy setting up the traps, right?
Yeah, I think eventually he throws a shuriken at him later on.
Yeah, but after he escapes the trapdoor, very similar to the Shang-Chi trapdoor in Black Jack Tar's house, he pulls himself up and then the wolf accosts him. Now, he takes out this wolf brutally, right? Looks like he kills the wolf because there's blood spurting from the wolf's neck after he karate chops him. Do you see that in your issue that you've got, Billy, the blood from the wolf's neck?
In the epic...
Yeah. It's there, right? The wolf is savaging his arm.
Yeah.
And then he karate chops the wolf's neck. But there's blood, black blood, spurting from the wolf's neck. The wolf's dead.
It does.
Yeah. Crazy. So
it is weird.
It's weird, but it obviously for a martial arts master like Iron Fist possible. But and then this is completely not unbelievable, but it's a miracle he escaped this, Billy. What happens when he enters the elevator?
Yeah, it's funny. He's like, another trap. The doors converge, sealing you in a chamber which quickly fills with gas. And the gas colors your mind in vivid hues of swirling vertigo. So then he just ends up using the Iron Fist to, like, smash out of the top of the elevator.
Yeah, and then worse is yet to come because he smashes through the elevator door as well with the Iron Fist. The elevator falls, and then he meets the mop samurai. But he takes this guy without the Iron Fist. I don't exactly know how he did it, but he charges the guy. The guy charges him. It's like this Lone Wolf and Cub style, you know, samurai charge.
Yeah.
Where they charge at each other and they pass, each taking a swipe at the other. And then at the end, you see one of them fall down. The loser collapses, right? So he used his open palm, with, like I said, without the power of the Iron Fist, to charge this guy and spack hit this guy somehow. So he dodged this guy's blade and then hit the guy on the head hard enough with his open palm to make his head bleed. Now, Billy, the
only... Bust him open, yeah.
Yeah, that is weird. The only thing I think could have happened was that he somehow slapped this guy's hand with the sword into his own head. I don't know what happened there. But it looks like this guy's dead. I'm not sure, but he definitely makes a sound like, ah, you know, and then collapses. Mm-hmm. And then you say, like you say, the
Doesn't
ninja.
Look good.
Yeah, the ninja shows mm-hmm. up. But you know, the funny thing, the ninja, again, like possibly like a typical ninja, he doesn't directly like to engage in the fight. He throws the shuriken and then hits a camera, but it's actually a laser, mm-hmm. a laser gun. And
yeah.
He hits the laser gun. And then, you know, what, has this ninja been helping him or what? You know, Billy, because at first I thought he threw the shuriken to you know, move the camera so that it would strike Iron Fist, but it damaged the lens, you know, the mechanism that would
aim. And the camera.
So this ninja's been helping him or something, I don't know. But the mob guy's gone, the defeated foe's gone, and then he smashes his way through into the final room, and that's where he finds this guy called Triple Iron. Now, Billy, this is possibly one of the worst costumes I've ever seen. He looks like a reject from Jack Kirby's Fourth World, but not without any of Jack Kirby's creativity. Doesn't he look like that?
Yeah, it is really goofy looking, and, you know, it's like...
Jeez.
It's the same thing in the end, the next issue, too. It's the same thing, too. He looks like a real goofball. It's definitely one of the worst costumes you'll ever see.
He looks like someone for a Rollerball reject. You know that movie Rollerball with the helmets? He's got a Rollerball helmet on. Then he's got nunchucks with three segments rather than just the two. And
yeah, I can't remember what that one's called.
Yeah, I don't even know either. But I think it can reattach itself as a staff or something. But yeah, it's not, I don't know, not a great costume design. And this is, I guess, on Larry Hama here. I mean, he would go on to design some great G.I. Joe costumes, but this is definitely not. And also some terrible ones, if you look at it. But I think that's more based off of the toy designs, right? Of the G.I. Joe, the bad G.I. Joes, if you think about it. Like Crystal Ball, you know, there's a guy called Crystal Ball. But, you know, Larry Hama, I think the Joes he came up with in the comic book, the designs, or the designs he tweaked from the... From who is it? Hasbro, right? That did the G.I. Joes.
Yeah.
Pretty good. The, you know, designs by Larry Hama. The interpretations of the designs. But, you know, here, this is...
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what he was thinking with this guy. I mean, this guy's even got, like, metal studs on his feet. You know, you'll only see that in the next issue, though. But it's just... Why?
Well,
it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, what, he's going to play a game of football on thick grass?
Yeah, you can kind of see those shoes a little bit on the bottom.
Or there could be weapons.
On that
who knows?
Last page. Yeah.
But okay, Billy. So definitely a weird issue here, man. Definitely not one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It's just nothing there. They could have done more. But, you know, we love the first two, so hopefully we didn't put the patrons on too much of a downer with this last issue, though.
Yeah, for real.
But give it time. Yeah. A couple more issues, and we'll have Claremont and Byrne. Just give it some time, listeners, and then we're getting to the real goodness. But, you know, there's going to be some pretty great Shang-Chi issues also coming, you know, still courtesy of Hama and Munch here. Don't lose all hope. But right now, it's firmly... I don't think they really knew what to do with the character yet. You know, maybe that's why it was the directionless, really. Because Roy was the one who came up with the concept, and then Roy didn't write, you know, so he was editing. But I don't think even Roy knew where to put the character. But before we get to Claremont and Byrne, though, we're going to have some Tony Isabella and Arvel Jones, right, Billy? And there's going to be some goodness there, too. You know, some great action panels. Sure. Yeah, from Arvel. Mm-hmm. Lots of black creators coming into their own here in these titles, right, Billy, from the 70s.
Oh, Billy Graham, earlier, especially Billy Graham. Oh
man, I love Billy Graham. I mean, we love him on the black and white magazines already, right? Where he did some stuff with Don McGregor, and then
here, Black Panther, yeah.
Black Panther, Billy Graham stuff's
brilliant.
Great. Damn, I love Billy Graham stuff, and I'm I'm sad. I don't know if you get this feeling, Billy, but he's not well remembered as a great Bronze Age artist. I mean, he did pencil well up into the 90s, and he's still, you know, penciled later on too. But you know what I mean? For me, he's a Bronze Age artist. And yeah. I don't know why he's not better remembered. He had so many great, you know, issues and you know, runs and art. Oh, man, I feel sad that somehow, I don't know, people don't remember him as one of the greats.
Yeah, hey, go to Twitter, and I think it might be his daughter that runs a Billy Graham account on Twitter. Go give that a good follow, man. It's, I think it's Artist Billy G or Artist Billy Graham or something like that, it says. Like, but it's a good follow. Definitely give that account some love.
Yeah, man, definitely. And all of these early black creators that Marvel hired, they were definitely talent. They weren't hired because they were black. You know, it wasn't Marvel trying to make a statement. Of course, Marvel was more open to hiring black creators. But, you know, these guys were legitimately fantastic artists. Arvell Jones, Billy Graham, definitely. So, Billy, that's it for our Dragons and Jive. But like I say, we've got some really great issues coming up in the future.
Oh, yeah. You
know, we've got another Shang-Chi that we're going to be looking at. And this time around, like we said, the previous one was called Alliance, Paul Gulacy. You've got that to look forward to, Paul Gulacy art. And then more of Shang-Chi versus Fu Manchu in the next issue. And then we've got some fantastic martial arts action lined up. This is the issue, Billy, that I told you about. When was it? I think, it's when we did on the regular Into the Weird. When we discussed, when we did the Man-Thing crossover, you know, with Shang-Chi, the Marvel team-up,
right?
Oh,
yeah.
And this is the one. Now, we already talked about this on the previous Marvel Into the Weird, so I'm going to mention this again. This is the issue I mentioned where he has to stop Fu Manchu from, you know, sending this kind of this opium, you know, this opium across the sea on this container. And then Shang-Chi... Whoa, this is one of his most badass moments. He takes out this ship. It's not opium. It's like mimosa. It's called mimosa, right?
This drug. Yeah, it's like a mind-altering drug, yeah.
Yeah, but it's definitely based off of opium. If you think about, you know, the Sex Rohmer books, they were all, you know, lots of them were obviously Fu Manchu smuggling opium. This is his own drug, mimosa. But, you know, Shang-Chi, he's under the influence of this drug. And even in the Man-Thing comic too, right? You remember... But he still manages to take out this cadre of, well, this one elite assassin and this cadre of soldiers of Fu Manchu. And then he manages to destroy the entire boat in the most badass way possible. You won't believe it. While having his hands tied behind his back. So it's incredible. So we'll get to that. You know, you've got that to look forward to for the next month of Patreon shows, listeners. And then on the Luke Cage front, we've got some more Billy Graham art with Archie Goodman writing, and we've got a guy called the Phantom who's going to show up. The Phantom of, what is it, 42nd Street, I think it is.
Yeah, and, this is crazy.
This is crazy. This is another kooky, weird Luke Cage villain. But, you know, Luke Cage is going to be known for that, for his super weird villains.
Oh, yeah.
And that makes him ideal for Into the Weird, right, Billy?
Uh-huh. Oh, he's a perfect character. The villains alone are just... you'll just laugh, like, because they are just hilarious.
Now this villain, Billy, this villain, you've read this issue, obviously. The next one coming up, listeners, we're previewing it now. It's fantastic. This is obviously based off of the Phantom of the Opera, but you won't believe this guy. So all I'm gonna say is Armandi the acrobat. Oh, it's gonna be good. So, and then with Iron Fist, though, we're going to have the fight with Triple Iron, which is lengthy, it's drawn out, it's not that great, but, you know, it's better than this issue, at least. So, so stay with us, please, patrons, that's my point. And thanks for your support, we really, really appreciate it. And send us some feedback, we'll engage with you on the Patreon site. And we've got some things planned, right, Billy? We're going to go for polls, and we're going to go for more interaction. Even for the $1 tier, you'll be able to participate in polls, and then you can vote for the Into the Weird episodes we're going to be covering, you know, between the Doctor Strange issues on the regular show as well. You can vote for that. So lots of goodness coming up. We're going to keep tweaking the Patreon and providing more and more rewards, but I don't think we're going to up the, you know, the tiers in terms of the money. You know, we're just going to keep adding the rewards to the tiers we already have, because we're satisfied with that at the moment. You know, so well, we're going to be giving you more content for your support that you're already giving us. And thanks for that again.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, Billy, enough jive, you know, enough philosophizing, enough, like you say, fortune cookies, wisdom. We're heading out. We're going to take some well-deserved rest, but we'll be back with more shows next month. So with that, it's bye from me.
All right, take care, everybody.
Cheerio.